Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
It's 8 o'clock Thursday night, and this is The Writer's Block. My name is Jim Christina, and we're sitting across the table from the lovely Bobby Jean Bell. And in studio tonight, we have C. Courtney Joyner, or Court Joyner, as he prefers to be called.
The lovely C. Courtney.
The lovely Court Joyner. And an old friend, and actually an old radio host, Russ Avison, who used to have his Tommy Dog Radio here at LATalkRadio.com, but he has since become a bum.
Thank
and
you.
He no longer has his radio show here at LA Talk Radio. We have been a year and a half trying to get this thing on the road, and we're very excited to be here tonight. I have to tell you a little funny story. I was talking to one of our authors that we're trying to get booked for August, and I called him today while I was at lunch, and he answered his phone, and we chatted for a while, and I told him that August was going to be the time when he was going to be able to be booked, and August 6th, could he write that down and call me when he can verify. He goes, "Do you know where I am?" And I said, "No, are you in CME?" And he goes, "No, I'm in Ireland." I said, "First of all, what the hell are you doing in Ireland?" And he goes, "Well, my brother and I decided to take a trip to Ireland." And I said, "Okay, so let me tell you in Irish. You're lucky. And you're a son of a bitch." So, anyway.
So, did you book him?
I actually have not completed booking him yet. He's one of these new guys, kind of like I was 5-6 years ago. But Court, we're so happy that you're here and you're our very first guest.
Well, thank you. This is a wonderful honor, and this sure was nice of you guys to invite me.
Well, we wanted you to be the very first because you are provocative and you're a good speaker, and you know a lot of stuff, and you know a lot of people, and you have a lot of good stories, so.
Oh, my gosh.
So that pretty much sets up what we're looking for guests.
Exactly. It kind of gives you a ground track of what you're looking for
guests. The pressure is on.
The pressure is on. But next week, see, we have Joyce Fitzpatrick coming in, which she is also provocative and far cuter than you are.
Oh, goodness.
I think he's okay.
No, I was talking about you, Russ. Oh. Anyway, Bobby, do you have some information you wanted to give us?
I do. I am going to introduce our first... officially introduce our very first guest tonight, C. Courtney Joyner. We do love to call him Court. He's an award-winning writer of fiction, comics, and screenplays with over 25 produced movies to his credit, including Class of 1999, Vietnam, Texas, and the upcoming The Return of Captain Nemo.
Uh-oh.
His movie book, The Westerners, Interviews with Actors, Directors, and Writers, was published by McFarlane to excellent reviews, and there's a second volume in the works. And he's currently finishing Warner Brothers' Fantastic, a history of the studio's horror, science fiction, and fantasy films. He's been nominated for the Peacemaker for Best Short Story twice, once for Two Bit Kill and another for Christmas for Evangeline from the collection Six Guns and Sleigh Bells. And for the past 3 years, he has written a regular column in True West Magazine and is a regular contributor to the Western Writers of America's monthly magazine, The Roundup. His first novel, Shotgun, I could not put this book down. It is a real page-turner. Matthew Mayo, an award-winning author, says this about Shotgun: "Readers be warned, they'll need a bullwhip, a hair trigger, and a fast horse just to keep up. This book is relentless, and Shotgun 2 is in the works." Courtney is a member of the Western Writers of America, serves on the Spur Award judge for that organization, and was honored with the President's Award in 2010. And he lives right here in Los Angeles. Please welcome to the Writer's Block our very first distinguished guest, Courtney Joyner.
Hey, wow, thank you.
She didn't lie, did she, Courtney?
And after all that,
nothing but lies.
There was so much there, and unfortunately we're out of time, but thanks for joining us tonight.
It was my pleasure.
I have to tell you, Court, I read your book, The Westerners, and because we did that deal about 6 years ago, mm-hmm. and I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
Oh, thank you.
The interview with Warren Oates was just unbelievable, and I to this day I don't know how you got to him.
That was such a stroke of incredible luck and good fortune, because he was such an incredibly nice man. When I was at USC, I decided I wanted to do a documentary on the Sam Peckinpah, and this was about 1980, and I was in a Western film class, and this was really to get out of writing a term paper. So I started to write letters to folks, and got some lovely responses from L.Q. Jones and people like that, and I was just this film student. And I wrote to Warren Oates, and he wrote back to me. I forget what he was doing a television movie, and he wrote back an incredibly nice letter and gave me his home phone number and said he would be thrilled to help me out because I was a college student. And not only did he sit down with us to do this interview, which was very long, very extensive, he just turned out to be such a wonderful, nice man and such a great supporter and friend. And in fact, about a year after we did our piece together, and this was actually for the documentary, it had never been published, his wife was expecting a baby, and he was kind of sitting around the house going a little bit stir crazy. And my professor at USC was getting ready to screen the long cut of The Wild Bunch. Now, this is, again, this is 1980. So this is, the film had not been seen in a very, very long time. And Sam Peckinpah was in town. So I called Warren and I asked him, would you like to come see the movie? He was like, absolutely, because he just wanted to get out of the house. And he said, is Sam coming? And I said, I didn't know. Is he here? And he says, because he was living in Montana at that time. He said, yeah, he's over at the Beverly Hills Hotel. So I sent a friend over to pick up Peckinpah. So here's my poor Western movie teacher getting ready to unveil the film. And we walked in with the director and the star.
Oh, man.
And I got to sit between the two of them while watching that movie. So that was my private commentary track.
Oh, my gosh. That's such a great story. It really, truly is. But that whole book is good. You've got some great interviews in there.
Thank you. If I could do one more little plug about that book. When I was finishing it off, and a lot of those interviews were really, they were just people I was fortunate enough to know, and I asked them because I really didn't have any intention of doing anything with the interviews other than I wanted them for posterity. And then I sold a few to some magazines, but mostly they just existed. The publishers wanted one more big name, and of course they would prefer it if I had gotten Clint Eastwood or someone. But I approached Elmore Leonard, and I just got his address and just wrote him in Detroit. He called me immediately. We did the interview. He was so gracious about the book that he then promoted it in a couple of interviews and even had it up on his website. And kind of followed what I was doing ever since. So I've been extremely lucky with that kind of circumstance.
That's Elmore Leonard of Raylan Givens fame.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Absolutely.
I think I need to sit a little closer to you so some of that will rub off. Oh, yeah. That's pretty amazing.
Oh, incidentally, Bobby's husband, Jim, is over here propping up the wall. So I'd like to welcome you tonight, too, Jim. A few minutes before we go to break, and I'd like to ask you your thoughts on we're going to talk about a Western genre now for a little while.
Yes, sir.
And your thoughts on what's happening with our Western genre, the writers, and where things are going with that.
Well, I think the probably the most unfortunate thing about the Western genre right now is the doomsaying. Because you always get this, oh my gosh, they don't make Westerns anymore, no one's writing them anymore, and the exact opposite is true. There are more Westerns being made now than probably in at least 10 years. Texas Rising, that debuts this weekend. Mm-hmm. MGM is doing the remake of The Magnificent Seven. Warner Brothers has The Rifleman ready to go. of course, Quentin is coming out with Hateful Eight. And then we have this whole plethora of miniseries, new westerns that are being done by HBO, more stuff coming out from the History Channel. That was not the case 10 years ago.
Yeah, it wasn't.
And so this idea that westerns aren't happening, it just doesn't jibe with the facts. It's the stuff is out there, and it's being done by real filmmakers for real money and real budget. So I think it's very exciting because, my God, it was a parched desert a decade ago. And you could not go to a movie studio or a television company and say, oh, I have an idea for a Western. They'd call security on you so fast you couldn't even get back to your Mazda.
What is the demographic for the Western genre as opposed to, like, I mean, I see on the television the advertisements for the films now, it's mostly, you know, superheroes, the Avengers, and, you know, what's the one about the galaxy, Guardians of the Galaxy, everything is superhero. Who looks at the Westerns? I would have to think it's an older.
You know, I think that's kind of a tough question because, yeah, of course, I think traditionally the demographic is perceived as being older and also probably perceived as being a little more politically conservative. That is, and it is not true, because take, for example, the remake of True Grit that the Coen brothers did with Jeff Bridges. That movie was incredibly successful, and it was incredibly successful because teenage girls embraced it, which was an audience that I'm sure they hadn't even considered. And that's what actually put that movie over the top, which was just a wonderful plus, because they were like, oh my gosh, we would never even have considered that as a potential audience for this movie. Obviously, when Quentin did Django, everybody turned out because it was him.
Right,
right, right.
But then the movie took off on its own, because if he had made a movie that people didn't like, it wouldn't have been as successful as it was. And, of course, it ended up being his most successful movie that he had ever been associated with. So now he is doing yet another Western. So, obviously, it's skewed to a much broader audience. But I think that the older audience for Westerns, or what we would consider the traditional audience, is probably the audience that sees Westerns at home, that would watch the miniseries and what have you. But now, when you say older, we're just talking about baby boomers. We're talking about people over the age of 35.
Well, I know that my mother complains that my dad is in front of the TV all the time with his Westerns. That's all he does is watches his Westerns, yes.
Okay, we're going to go to a break here real quick, and we'll be back in about 30, 35 seconds. We're here with Court Joyner, Russ Avison, and my lovely co-host, Bobby Jean Bell. Okay, we're back with you. I'd like to just mention that this wonderful broadcast is being brought to you by Black Dog Publishing of Simi Valley. Black Dog Publishing, where we make publishing personal. And by Out West Boutique and Cultural Center in Newhall, California, where you can go and get some of the finest Western stuff, gear, accessories, mostly just good stuff.
Including books.
Including books, which actually Court's
and
book
CDs.
Is there. My books is there.
Yes. And CDs, even.
And CDs. And I think now, let's kind of change it up a little bit, Court. Let's talk about your study on spaghetti Westerns.
Well, I guess, first we should kind of place everything in the proper chronological context. I'm 56 years old, so growing up in the middle of Euro Westerns had kind of gone away when I started paying attention to them. So I saw The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly on the ABC Sunday night movie. So that had kind of passed. So it was a matter of discovering what those movies were. And in fact, I finally saw Once Upon a Time in the West on a bottom of like a quadruple bill at a drive-in when I was like 14. And it just absolutely knocked me out.
Oh, it's classic.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's interesting because now that everyone looks back at the work and, say, a movie like Django and putting that into the context of Fistful of Dollars and what Sergio Leone and Sergio Corbucci and all these filmmakers were doing at that time in the early 60s, but they're also looking at the artistic achievement because you also have to look at the fact that this was the commercial reality of the Italian movie business at that time. Foreign money was being matched by U.S. distributors, and they wanted Westerns. And that was it. They were successful, and that's what it was, because they were also making horror films and what have you. But the international banking community was involved with film production, and so suddenly the floodgates open, and this genre happened to be the great benefit of it, because, of course, the Leone movies did so astoundingly well, and then that created the startup for people like Lee Van Cleef, and of course Franco Nero came into his own and what have you. But there was this incredible work that was being done that was kind of dismissed because there were so many that were made at once, and they kind of burned themselves out. And now people go back and they see a movie like A Bullet for the General or Cutthroats 9 or Django or Massacre Time or any of these movies, and they're going, wow, this is really wonderful stuff, and always made for usually very little money.
Hmm. Let me ask you, if you look at all these films, and I remember Good, Bad, and the Ugly, I'm just a little bit older than you, so when I actually saw it in its first release, but my parents had come home from a trip one time, and they brought me the record album because the music was also incredible. They said, we saw this film, and so I saw it. But what films would you say, like Silverado and Unforgiven and some of these, what actually represents the reality of the Old West at that time? Because there's such a variety of films. And the latest, what was it, Million Ways to Die in the West, which was obviously a comedy and it was a spoof. But what really reflects the reality of it?
The real harsh realities of life on the frontier and the West, I think. You would have to go to movies like, well, of course, Unforgiven is a gunfighter story, but beautifully done. And the image of what a Western town was for Unforgiven is so accurate.
It's right on.
It really is. The mud and the construction, which is always ongoing and usually very poor and what have you, and the desolation. The proposition is a very realistic Western. But those interesting, some people really gravitate towards that, and then others shy away from it because it's like, oh my gosh, no, this is, I can't watch somebody skinning a pig. I can't watch the reality of how harsh life was at that time. I want the classic Louis L'Amour mythos. I want the John Wayne mythos. But the genre supports both.
Now, what about Deadwood?
I was just going to ask about Deadwood.
And the big controversy was, of course, they never really talked like that in the West. Did they?
To a degree, I think they did.
Yeah?
Yeah. But the F-bomb that was being thrown out in Deadwood, actually at the time, was almost thrown out by more women than men. Hmm. Especially because saloon was a place for men to go.
Right.
And there was no women allowed in saloons. There was dance halls and there was brothels where the women could go. Which the dance halls is what's depicted now as a saloon in Western.
Right.
But the women were very harsh and they were very foul-mouthed.
Mm.
So I think that's where a lot of that came from.
Oh, so I was born in the wrong century then.
Well, I think we all were.
But of course, the reaction to the language in Deadwood, that was also, a terrific ploy because it got viewership.
It did.
And Deadwood was an enormous success. And no one would even touch a Western for years, certainly not at the level of doing something for HBO. And then along came Deadwood, executive produced by our old friend A.C. Lyles, of all people. And the whole issue of the language and the controversy about that brought it a great deal of attention, and people tuned in. If that was the reason they tuned in, they did tune in, and then they got hooked because the show was wonderful.
I think one of the biggest comments about the language in Deadwood was that it was almost Shakespearean in the way that it was being spoken. Al Swearengen was, particularly good at that.
I think one of the most beautiful examples of the use of formal Victorian English in dialogue is Charles Portis's True Grit, and the way that was adopted in both versions by the Coen brothers and by Marguerite Roberts, who wrote the screenplay for the John Wayne version. It will feel like a ton of brick had fell upon you. That kind of formality in language and the use of English at that time was very common. And anyone who's ever read letters from that period, they're always very surprised about how literate they are.
Right.
And very, very formal in their structure and in their vocabulary choice, because that was how they learned. That was the very strict use of language that was taught in schoolhouse.
What's your take on... because Larry McMurtry, of course, is everybody's god when it comes to Westerns, on the Lonesome Dove, because I love Lonesome Dove, but then I catch things in it all the time.
Well, Lonesome Dove, of course, Lonesome Dove started as a screenplay.
Right.
And when, as we know, that when they were shooting The Last Picture Show and Peter Bogdanovich asked Larry McMurtry to write a script for John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart and Henry Fonda.
Right.
And they couldn't get the movie deal together. Wayne, of course, got ill, and Fonda and Stewart were getting older, and it was tough to pull all the elements together. And he was sitting there with his script, and then he turned that into this just tremendous novel that Suzanne de Pass ended up reading in galleys. And a lot of people don't even know that in order for the miniseries to happen, she actually got the money from Berry Gordy, because she was the president of Motown at the time.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and that's who bought Lonesome Dove, and suddenly there we are with this tremendous miniseries. I think it's an amazing accomplishment. I love the miniseries, but the book is, of course, it won the Pulitzer Prize. It's on an entirely different level and a different, experience with what McMurtry did on the page.
I think Lonesome Dove and actually the three subsequent novels, Dead Man's Walk, Comanche Moon, and Streets of Laredo.
Streets of Laredo.
The novels were incredibly good.
Well, also, too, McMurtry, everyone always forgets that he really turned Westerns on their ear originally with Horsemen Pass By.
Yes.
Which, of course, became the movie HUD. And, boy, you could not ask for a more harsh examination of the cowboy lifestyle than when that book was written, than that book. It's just an astonishing piece.
It really is. I understand, and we've been talking today. Bobby Jean put up a Facebook page for us this morning, and within 3 or 4 hours, it started getting likes all over the place, and by the time we got here tonight, I had a bunch. I won't say how many, but it was a bunch.
It was very exciting to see it happen, actually.
And I think a lot of the people knew that you were coming tonight. And I think a lot of them really wanted to hear both of your friends.
Yes.
all of our listener. I think a lot of people want to hear about your new project that you're going to be doing in England about Captain Nemo.
Well, we're just now finally getting on the road with that. And I'm very excited about that. I'm finishing off the novel first. I had written a script that was then turned into a novel that will be for Tor Forge. And then from there, we're going to be doing the a pilot, anyway, for a television series. And that will be done in overseas. And so I'm very pleased about that. This only took about 22 years to happen. So actually, fast-tracked.
Yeah, that's what you're saying in the green room. 35 years out of your life. And now, let's go back to Shotgun for a minute, because I know that you're also working on a sequel.
Yes, the sequel actually will be out not this October, next October. Shotgun 2, The Bleeding Ground. And in fact...
Oh, we're wearing the shirt,
aren't we?
Wearing the shirt. When I turned in the manuscript, and I forget, I had given it a subtitle. I can't even remember what it was. It wasn't very good. And a very nice lady called me from the publishers and said, we've decided to retitle it. And I said, oh, what are you calling it? She said, The Bleeding Ground. I said, oh, I like that. And there was this very nice pause. She said, you know, that's the title of one of your chapters. Do you not know your own book? And I had to admit that, oh, gee, no, I didn't. I had forgotten that.
Well, Shotgun has such an interesting backstory, the first book, Court. And again, another endeavor that took you a really long time to get it from first thought to printed copy. But I think it's a great story. Can you tell us a little bit about how Shotgun came about?
Shotgun actually came about because I was working on a movie that was never made. With a director by the name of John Flynn. And John was a really, really talented filmmaker. And one of his more famous movies, actually is a movie, a favorite of Quentin's, is called Rolling Thunder. And that's the movie where William Devane has his hand ground off in the garbage disposal by James Best and Luke Askew, and then goes after the guys responsible. Paul Schrader wrote it. And John and I were having lunch one day, and I said, John, I always thought that would make a great Western. And John goes, oh, why don't you write that? That'd be fun. Let's do that. So, well, about 10 years down the road, I finally thought, I'd really like to do something like this, but do it in the style of the really outrageous spaghetti Westerns, like the Stranger series with Tony Anthony and what have you. I was nursing myself after a divorce, so I decided, well, I'm going to try and write this as a novel. And I couldn't do it. So then I decided to try and write it as a screenplay. And I got about three-quarters of the way through, and then I said, well, this really isn't working. And then I tried it as a television presentation. That led to the comic book. And I went and, through some great friends, was hooked up with a wonderful artist, and he did a beautiful presentation for Shotgun as the comic book that we could not sell. And we went to Dark Horse and all the publishers, and he had done a spectacular job. And this guy was quite big. He worked for Marvel, but we couldn't get anybody interested in it. And this is all pre-True Grit and pre-Django, so people weren't really looking for Westerns at this point, and Dynamite Entertainment had not had their big success with Lone Ranger. So then I took all this stuff to a friend of mine at an animation studio. We decided to try and do the first animated spaghetti Western. This is absolutely true. So we worked on that for a year. Nothing. Okay. So now about 20 years have passed. Poor John had passed away. Everything is... And I had all this material, all these false starts and all this artwork and everything else stacked up. And finally, Gary Goldstein from Pinnacle Books, we were talking. And I had written, worked on a number of film books for Goldstein and the Westerns. In fact, one of them, Duke, we're glad we knew you and some things like that. And they had published my first short story, really, that got some exposure. And that was a 2-Bit Kill in the collection Law of the Gun, had John Jakes and some other guys in it. It was wonderful. So he asked me, what are you doing about a novel? And I said, I've got this thing. Would you like to take a look at it? So I sent him everything. It was just like backing up a dump truck and all went colliding into his office. And he read it, and he actually asked me, he said, what do we have on Django? I said, I don't have anything on Django. The movie was being shot. Gary got some stills or something, put it together, went into the boardroom, and said, this is the audience we have got to capture. And then he dumped all the Shotgun stuff in front of the board members. And that was literally how it happened. I had the deal to write the novel about 3 days later.
Wow.
After 20 years.
I remember having a conversation with you at one of the author events at Out West Boutique and Cultural Center. That you had said that you had a Western book that you had been working on for over 20 years and you would like to get it finished someday.
Well, the thing was, of course, the final shape that the novel took really bore almost no resemblance to what I started out with. So those were all false starts and abandoned tries and all that process that you go through. And so I'm glad I did go through it. Although it took me a while to do it because I was brand new. I'd never written a novel before in my life.
That's what you were saying, yeah. So this was your first one.
Absolutely, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about Dr. John Bishop.
Can we hold that for a second? We need to take a break.
Absolutely.
And we'll be back in a little bit. And here we go. Okay, we're back.
Okay.
And we're back with Court Joyner and Russ Avison and Bobby Jean Bell.
And Court, we were talking about Shotgun. It's such a great story behind, you know, I often find the stories behind the titles are almost more interesting sometimes than the books.
Yes, especially you know, in this case.
The stories behind the titles. As I said before, though, I was really taken with this book and could not put it down. And found that I had a great respect for the main character, Dr. John Bishop. And, of course, there's a beautiful gal that enters his life, White Fox. And without giving anything away and giving a little bit of a teaser so that our audience will want to go get this book right away, tell us a little bit about those two characters.
Well, my father was a doctor. He was a cardiologist. And I remember that we had some Civil War memorabilia in the house, and it was medical equipment. And there were some laudanum bottles and some things that had been passed down. And one of the things that we did have was a field manual for doctors. Of course, absolutely everything was amputations. But I was fascinated by this, and he had been a field medic in the mm-hmm. Korean War. So I was kind of fascinated by what physicians had to contend with at that time. So I always thought that would be a great launching pad for anyone. And also, too, I love the idea, and I kind of pushed this a little bit further in the second book, that here's this guy who's on this violent revenge thing, but he's also split right down the middle because, of course, his training is to help anybody with a gunshot wound or anybody who's been blown in half. So he shoots them, and then he tries to patch them up again. Yes. So yes, so the eternal conflict, yes.
And there's a reason that he's called Shotgun.
Yes, well, that is because when he has a conflict with some outlaws, and they sever one of his arm, and he is left to bleed to death in the snow, and he's rescued, and he decides that the best way to this was kind of interesting thinking on his part, but actually has a double-barreled shotgun affixed to his arm to take its place, and he uses that as his weapon because he can't hold a gun anymore.
A little steampunk going on there?
A little bit of steampunk. But the thing was, when I went to a very good friend of mine who's an armorer, Mike Tristano, and I told him what I wanted to do. And I was through the Western Writers of America. I also checked with a lot of guys who were gunsmiths and what have you, and people like Peter, of course. And I said, is this possible? And they all said, oh, absolutely it is. But what model are you going to use? And Mike had done the gun work for 310 to Yuma. Oh. So he said, there is a Swedish model shotgun that was used by Stagecoach riders that you should take a look at because it's side loading. We didn't want something that opened toward down. The front. It had to go to the right or the left because of his inability to move his limb. So we actually took pictures of that, and that was then fashioned into, photoshopped into the cover. But we just put that on the floor of the living room, and that's what we used, and that was the basis for the weapon.
It's so cool.
It really is.
It really is. And then tell us a little bit about White Fox and how you were inspired to write her character.
Well, of course, I wanted a woman character in the novel anyway, because I wanted a compatriot, and not just. The fact is, because she's a Cheyenne, and I didn't just want it to be a female version of Tonto, that she had to be a warrior, she had to be a fighter on her own, and she felt indebted to this man because he had taken her away from an abusive relationship. But also the thing is, too, that very often, of course, in Westerns, certainly in the ones that we grew up with, many of them, you generally, with a lot of the female characters, were basically the women were going to be the ones standing by the chuck wagon, wringing their hands in abject fear while whoever it was goes to fight Lee Van Cleef and the marauding outlaws. So I didn't want to do that. And also, too, this was because it was an action piece, there was a wonderful piece about writing that Alistair MacLean wrote for years ago. I forget for what magazine. But I was reading this article, and he brought up something I thought was so apt. And it was that, of course, he had the freedom fighters in The Guns of Navarone, and they're both women. And there's no romance. And he said it is entirely inappropriate for that to happen in that circumstance. And he said he would get pressure. Of course, later on in other books and what have you, when it was appropriate, it works. But he said it's just so inappropriate for these guys on a commando mission and everything else, and everyone, that's what their mind is on, to stop and have this big clinch and what have you. And I love that. I thought that was great advice and very realistic, and that was the kind of female character I want. Of course, they do eventually get together, but that's not what the point is, and right. It's certainly not a romance.
And does she appear in the second? Is she with us in the second book?
The structure of the second book is it literally takes place about a half an hour after the first one ends.
Okay.
So she's actually not in it that much because she has taken off. And I was like, well, what do I do here for this second thing? Because I felt we had all these unanswered questions. I had to kind of finish off this big story. And I thought, wait a sec. Where we've left this guy, he's been blown up by a grenade. So he wakes up in a bed. And let's say whenever we read Westerns or we see Western movies, and especially at the end, the good guy comes in and he wipes out 300 bad guys, and then he rides away. I was like, well, no. Our guy wipes out 300 bad guys, and they're going to hang him. So he wakes up.
Appropriate.
He is handcuffed to a bed. He's in a jail cell, and he doesn't remember a thing. Ooh. Because of the concussion from the grenade. Has no idea why he's there. And that's where we start.
Oh, I can't
what
wait to read it. When's it coming out?
October. Yeah, so you've got about a year to... Fortunately, though, what is supposed to happen is that Pinnacle Books is going to reissue the first volume, also as an e-book, and do a little promotion, because really to try and tie the two volumes together, because there has been a good deal of time between the release of the first and the second book, and they want to kind of close that gap.
Now, you've just released another new, you're part of an anthology, The Tall Tales of the Weird West.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me about that term, Weird West. I'm sort of starting to see that be used. What is a Weird Western? What does that term mean?
Well, I think now everyone looks at Weird Westerns as just kind of the genre hybrid when you involve either, as you said, you mentioned steampunk or science fiction elements or horror elements.
Cowboys and aliens,
exactly. And sometimes it's as extreme as that. Or it can be, in the case of the story that I had in Tall Tales of the Weird West, that was actually a reprint of an old short story of mine that had been published in England. And I had written a story about a young kind of Sugarfoot type deputy, a very naive kid, who is sent off to hunt down a killer who has murdered a girl, not realizing that he is a shapeshifter. So it's a werewolf story. But I used the Native American background to the story, and that was that's not probably the most original approach, but that usually it is the combination of all of these different disparate elements, because they, as Jim said, cowboys, and we've had everything from cowboys and aliens to Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Slayer.
Right. Now, which incidentally was a great movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All with
it was a great book. I bought into the premise pretty quickly when I read that book. It took a little bit. But, well, I'm about weird Westerns just for a moment. We were talking earlier about age groups and demographics. And I wonder if the bringing in of these other elements, is that partly helping this genre appeal to a younger audience, or to even the women who don't necessarily read Westerns?
I think it does. But also, too, the thing is, it's not just the shifting of the age of the audience. It's also the shifting of the age of the writers. Because now, who are writing Westerns are guys we grew up on Jack Kirby comic books. We grew up on Hammer films. We grew up on Sergio Leone movies. And so we kind of had that inundation of genre stuff and Conan the Barbarian paperbacks and all of that great stuff and Doc Savage, and that's where we came from.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And now we're writing those stories.
Right. I'd like to mention also that if you'd like to call in and talk to Court, the number here is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. We're going to take one more quick break, and we'll be back in a few. And once again, those phone numbers is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929 if you want to talk to Court Joyner, or you want to talk to Bobby, or you want to talk to Russ, or you want to talk to Jim over there against the wall.
So, Courtney, one of my favorite questions to talk to anybody that is in the creative field is...
We have a call.
Oh, how cool is that?
I'm serious as a heart attack.
Oh, my gosh. How do we take it?
Hi, you're on the writer's blog. Who am I speaking to?
You're speaking to Joe in Lake Isabella, and I love your show. I just wanted to mention you talked about A.T. Lyles. We go to the Lone Pine Film Festival every year and wondered if your guest has ever been there. We met A.T. there one year, and he was a delightful man, and of course he's passed away now. But I did talk to him about Deadwood and everything, and it's just a great place to go to see all the old cowboy movies. And
well, Joe Mom always loved you best. This is my cousin, Josephine. It's my cousin, Joe.
Oh, we're so happy you called in. What a great question about Lone Pine. Court, can you talk a little bit
about
that?
Actually, we did. I was there last year with Miles Swarthout. And Miles did his shoot his presentation, and it was terrific. And then we did a signing there with Ed Faulkner and just some Bruce Boxleitner and everything. It was terrific.
We've only missed three of them.
Wow.
Of the film festivals. And we stay at Boulder Creek, and it's just an amazing event. And we're trying to bring our younger kids to go and get them all involved because, you know, Westerns just aren't the thing anymore. But I buy my grandkids, like, the original Lone Ranger movie, how he got to be the Lone Ranger and stuff. I'm trying to get him into this kind of thing because it's just a great place to go. And AC, if you've never heard of his story about how he got to be producer at Paramount, and I still have his card he gave me, it's a wonderful story told. So, you know, you don't have time now, but I'll tell my cousin and he can repeat it.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
You had breakfast with Ed Burns, too, didn't you, one time?
Yeah,
you were
we did. Yeah. We always run into somebody there that's so interesting. And we went to, my mom and my sister were with me, and we went to eat, and there wasn't another table, and Ed Burns came and sat with us, and we got to visit with him. Every time we go, we meet and talk. Last year, it was Ronnie, what's his name, from The Rifleman?
Johnny Crawford.
Johnny Crawford was there. And, you know, he used to work at Roadway Trucking, because my husband worked at Roadway Trucking. And I said, why'd you work at Roadway Trucking? He said, because he couldn't get any work. Now he tours with an orchestra.
Right. Yes. Yep. Right. Yes. He sure does.
Oh, he sure does.
Okay,
yeah.
let's
you just never know. And we just love going and meeting these people. They're all down to earth, just cowboy Western people. And I've got a lot of stories, but.
Okay, here's the question. Johnny Crawford was killed by John Wayne in what movie?
Oh, I know the answer to this.
Johnny Crawford was killed by who in what movie? Was killed by John Wayne in what movie? Do you hear me?
I can hear you.
You can't hear me. He would know. I know you can hear me.
That's Sir Ronald retired.
Yeah, you be nice to me. I'll tell him.
Well,
about
the answer is...
What?
El Dorado.
El Dorado.
What movie did John Wayne kill Johnny Crawford? What movie?
El Dorado. We're
El
telling
Dorado.
You. We gave you the answer. Know. Okay, Joe, we got to go. I got
yes,
we got to wrap
take
it up.
Care. Love you.
Love you too. Talk to you soon. Bye bye.
Love the show.
Thank you.
Yay, there you go. See?
Okay, Court, we got a few minutes left.
I wasn't a collection agency, so.
No,
The only way they track you down
well,
these shows.
No, I believe that she used to work for a school district. She was the kitchen lady. We have a few minutes left. Let's go into what you've got going and give us all your information and how to get in touch with you. And
well,
blah, blah.
I guess really the next projects that are going to appear. Is a book that is just absolutely wonderful called The Fantastic Fictioneers that I wrote four chapters for. It's about the history, really, of fantasy and horror and going all the way, including Bram Stoker and Jules Verne and everyone involved with movies and what have you, all the way to the present day. And I wrote the chapters on Boris Karloff, Bela Lugosi, Wally Wood, the cartoonist, and Bird Eye Gordon. And it is a spectacular presentation. And it's going to be a giant two-volume set in a slipcase, and I'm very, very proud to be a part of this with Harlan Ellison and Stuart Gordon and Ray Bradbury, and it's quite a crew. So I was very fortunate to be part of that group.
Court, what's your website?
CCourtneyJoyner.com.
And your Facebook page?
It's just Courtney Joyner on Facebook. Yeah.
Yep. And his website is terrific, and also
which needs to be updated.
A great way to keep on top of what he has working on, and where you can find him, because you do go to film festivals and you do go out and do book signings.
That's right.
And
actually, I'll even do this. The film I did with Vincent Price, From a Whisper to a Scream, just got a tremendous Blu-ray release from. Shout Factory, and with a two-hour documentary about the making of the movie when we were all young kids and got him involved in our lives, and it's terrific. And also, we just did the commentary on Man, Pride, and Vengeance, Franco Nero and Klaus Kinski. That comes out next week from Blue Underground, and so that was very
excellent. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been great. It's been great. Will you come back and see us again?
I would be delighted.
Oh, good. We'll see?
Yes.
Apparently you had a good time.
Yes, I did. Yes,
I did too.
This was fun.
It was fun. Anything you'd like to say in parting, Bobby? We got about a minute and a half.
No, I just think that this was very exciting that we've got the writer's block up and rolling.
It's rolling.
Congratulations, a dream come true, Mr. Christina.
Well, thank you. And to you. Miss Bell. And next week, again, we have Joyce Fitzpatrick, who Russ will be my co-host next week. And she's a terrific writer. She's a screenwriter. She's a director. She's a producer. She's been a good friend ever since I met her on Bobby's show over in Santa Clarita. And she did a documentary on Discovering Mary, about Stagecoach Mary, and it's wonderful. And she's just the neatest lady. And with that, we're going to take this out. Thank you, everybody, for listening. All one person, my cousin, obviously.
thank you.
And we will talk to you next week.